Welcome back to our show. We have given the show a name, Murder Incorporated, a.k.a. CIA, KGB, MI5. Our guest is H.B. Abarelli, Jr., and he has written a true life thriller, really, and a shocker. It's called A Terrible Mistake, The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiment. If you listen to the first half hour, the conversation has gone beyond this incident, which happened back in the early 50s. But we need to get back to that story, which is pretty incredible in itself. First of all, Hank, at the break, we were discussing the political landscape and the frustration, almost hopelessness, of the people in general.
Well, they are, and it's all like it's almost like them against us now, and that's a dimension that's even more depressing and disappointing. Is that, you know, at one time, when I was a kid, at one time, you know, it was government, and yeah, you know, bureaucracy was cumbersome, but government was there to help us.
Mm-hmm.
The prevailing attitude now across the country is that it's us against government. That government's a hindrance, an obstacle, something that needs to be overcome to make life better, or to make your business more profitable, or to get by. And nobody views government as a useful tool or mechanism to help you get ahead. It's certainly a major obstacle now to small businesses. I know more small businesses across the country that are threatened by government. Just, you know, like some of these horrible regulations that have been put in place, both in terms of just business and education, and these people are just clinging by their fingernails to the few business that they have remaining, and they can't turn to government because it's government that's basically driving them out of business. And then people that are unemployed, you know, it's because of NAFTA and GATT, and you know, a lot of these plant closings have nothing to do with the economy. It's simply that they close up and move overseas. They go to China, they go to Mexico, they go Latin America, and they just chase the cheap wages. So for anybody not to understand and appreciate why people are getting frustrated and angry, it's baffling if you don't. People have every right to become that way.
Well,
you have over a million people unemployed in Ohio alone who may never go back to work again. What do you tell those million people?
Mm-hmm. We're going to get back to the subject here in a moment. This is not a bash Obama program, but as long as we're talking about the subject, I think when he ran on change,
right,
and then didn't change things, the damage was very, very severe, especially to younger voters. Voters who thought voting might make a difference. In many ways, I'm afraid he's done more damage than Bush Cheney.
Well, he did. He when he ran, and we all got sort of fooled into it. He used those two magic words that Americans love. He used hope, and he used change.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to bring put both of those things back into the body politic, and he was going to put both of those things back into everybody's working day and days of leisure with their family. He's going to bring hope and change to the country. And that I can see, there's no hope and change. The healthcare debate turned into a big joke and charade on people. They sold out to the insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all more slaves of the insurance companies than
yeah.
we ever have been. And they did that just so that they could say they had a victory. The only people celebrating that victory were maybe a handful of people in the White House and the Republicans, who knew that they really beat them at their own game.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say all this stuff because, I put myself in the camp still of people that want to see Obama succeed. I really expected him to go down as one of the best presidents this country ever had, only because he had the intellect to deliver on that. But
yeah, something happened.
Yeah, something terrible happened.
I mean, even with your book, it proves that conspiracies really do exist. And so it appears that some of these people who say, yeah, he got to the White House and somebody walked in the Oval Office and straightened him out.
Well, I think there's a good chance of that, or the message is conveyed subtly somehow.
Yeah, I think that's more likely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just if you look at Obama's appointment to head up the CIA, now I know the CIA has been undercut a lot by the whole Homeland Security apparatus and some of the other new intelligence levels, but Leon Panetta, I guess, was, you know, a fine guy and has done some good things in the past, but I don't know what qualified him to walk in and lead the CIA.
Yeah, that was kind of an amazing...
No, it was a really odd choice, and I suspect it was just to put somebody in there that could play the part but not rock the boat at all. And I think if the one thing I learned in writing my book, and that I could have written a book maybe two or three times as large as that book just by going off on into areas like drug trafficking and control of smaller countries and interference in other economies, is that the CIA is a massive organization. And so massive now that you can't even find anybody in Congress that can tell you what their budget is. And if you ask certain people in Congress that should know, I've had people in Congress actually tell me, I don't want to know. That's really not information.
And why do you think they say that?
I think they're absolutely afraid of the CIA.
Yeah.
I think they absolutely are. And they don't even know how many employees the agency has. At last count, believe it or not, the agency had over 100,000 employees worldwide. And nationwide, I've learned when I was researching the book that the CIA has something like 4,000 domestic corporations, small businesses in the United States that they operate. And these are everything from flower shops to bookstores to dry cleaners. And all it's said in the way of justification is that those things are needed to be in place in order to do their job. But these are domestic businesses, meaning businesses in the United States. And on top of that, the CIA has employees in every major city in the country. There's a CIA office not far from where I sit right now in Tampa. There's a CIA office in New York, Chicago, everywhere you go.
And what are
they
yet,
by charter, they're not supposed to operate
right.
in the United States.
And, Hank, what do you think they are doing in those offices? I mean, what are they doing?
Nobody would tell you.
Knows.
Some of them are very small offices.
Yeah,
I tried
understand.
To visit a couple, and you know, I couldn't get beyond the front desk, but it appeared as if maybe there were no more than five or six people working
uh-huh.
there. But maybe, you know, maybe somebody could say, well, there's a CIA office in Tampa because, you know, the command is in
yeah.
Tampa
mm-hmm.
for the war, the command center and all the technology, and maybe it has something to do with defending that. But on top of the CIA, there's a huge apparatus, there's a huge organization of Army intelligence that doesn't even talk to the CIA people. So it doesn't seem like you'd need all those layers. When Frank Olson was killed in 1953, one of the startling things I learned is that immediately after his death, after his murder, that we subsequently learned it was his murder, CIA agents were dispatched to both the hotel and the medical examiner's office in New York City and to the New York City Police Department. And I assumed before I looked at the files that I was going to see that they either got on a quick airplane out of Washington, D.C. and traveled to New York or got on a fast train. This is 1953. But what I learned was that they were there within minutes, which means they came out of the New York office. The New York office at that point in time was in Rockefeller Center. And they had basically inherited the same offices that the OSS had occupied during the Second World War. But they flooded New York City with agents to cover up Olson's murder, and remarkably enough, within an hour, had successfully done that, and had actually gone to all the newspapers. And the next day, when the sun came up, Olson died at 2:30 in the morning. At 6 o'clock the next morning, when all the newspapers came out in New York City and Washington D.C., there was just a little notice that said a guy called Frank Olson jumped out of a window in a hotel in New York because he was depressed and died. But what the article didn't say was that he didn't just jump out of a window. He jumped through a window that was closed and had a canvas shade and a curtain drawn in front of it. It was 2:30 in the morning. There wasn't a light on in the room, but there was a CIA man in the room who was there when the police came, the uniformed police came. And the first question they asked the CIA fella, his name was Robert Lashbrook, and he didn't identify himself as CIA to the police, but they said, "Why, are you aware of the fact that your friend is dead on the sidewalk outside?" And Lashbrook said, "Yes, I am." And the other cop said, "Well, why didn't you go out and check on him once you realized he'd gone through the window?" And Lashbrook's reply, according to the police report, this isn't a CIA report, was, "Well, I knew he was dead, so I figured I'd just sit here and wait for you to come." I interviewed another person who was present when that question was asked was the night manager of the Statler Hotel in 1953, and he had actually gone up to the room and let the police in. And so he was standing behind the two uniformed police officers when Lashbrook said that. And when I interviewed him many, many years later down here in Florida at his home, he still got angry about it. And he almost exploded, and he jumped up from the couch and he says, "Well, what kind of animal reacts like that? Your friend's dead on the sidewalk and you're just sitting in the room waiting for the police to come?" And his name was Armand Pastore, and all I could say was, "Armand, I don't know." You know, I said, any normal person would have been, you know, running down the stairs or going down in the elevator and trying to find out what was happening. Olson actually died in Armand Pastore's arms. He actually lived after falling 170 feet, and Pastore ran outside when he realized somebody had gone out the hotel window, and Olson was trying desperately to say something to him, but was so broken up inside that he was unable to, and he just died as Pastore was trying to hear what he was saying.
You figure this Lashbrook fellow did it?
No, Lashbrook didn't do it. What the book reveals, and I don't want to ruin a story.
Yeah, I understand.
That there were actually two people in the adjoining room. There was an adjoining room to the room Lashbrook and Olson was in. They were in room 1018A. And in the B room, which connected to their room, were two contract employees for the CIA who came in the middle of the night to take Olson out of the hotel. Olson, a couple nights earlier, had gotten wind of the fact, or not gotten wind, but realized that his number was up, and he had been indiscreet his past few months of employment with the CIA and the Army, and he talked out of school about a number of experiments, thinking that he was going to leave work with the Army and the CIA and retrain himself as a dentist. But the CIA and Army were extremely concerned about his indiscretions, and they took him to New York for basically a damage assessment. And when he realized that, when he really realized what was going on, two nights before his death, he actually tried to escape the hotel, but he was apprehended by these same two characters and brought back. And then on the night that he died, the same thing happened. He thought, you know, he could leave at 2:30 in the morning. Two nights earlier, he had actually thrown, at least the CIA report says he had actually thrown his wallet and credentials away. And I can't imagine why. But I think they took them away so he wouldn't be able to travel. But when he tried to leave the room again, there was a struggle, and he was thrown through the window, through the closed window. And certainly nobody would plan a death that way to
Don't tell me, but I bet you no one was prosecuted.
No one was ever prosecuted, and everyone believed from 1953 until 1975 that he had simply become depressed and killed himself. And then in 1975, it was revealed through the Rockefeller Commission that Frank Olson had been given LSD by the CIA 9 days before his death. And then the story that was cooked up then was, well, that's what made him depressed, because he'd been given LSD. But the amount of LSD that he had been given was absurdly small. And again, it was for interrogation purposes to do damage assessment on him. And when, in 1975, when a few savvy investigative reporters started asking more questions that they about the story that the White House put up, this was Gerald Ford's White House then. Again, the White House went into overdrive and did yet another cover-up of the Olson death. And the two people, remarkably enough, that led that cover-up effort were Donald Rumsfeld, who was Gerald Ford's chief of staff, and Rumsfeld's special assistant, who happened to be Dick Cheney.
Wow.
And there was a very elaborate cover-up unrolled in 1975, and the Olson death yet again went down as basically a suicide because of depression.
Why was Olson so important to some people in high places in Washington?
Well, he wasn't. What was really important, it took me 6-7 years to find this out. What Olson had committed a mortal sin with the agency and the army. He thought he was going to leave, and as a man, he was fairly arrogant and outspoken to begin with. He was really in the wrong environment from the get-go. He wasn't a person that cared much for authority or authority figures. He was very egotistical and as said, arrogant and outspoken. And when he decided he was going to leave employment with the Army and the CIA, he thought, I guess he thought he was being cute or whatever, and he talked to a number of people about things he shouldn't have talked to. And all of these people reported him back to various Army and agency authorities. And one of the things that Olson talked about that upset them the most and caused them to do this damage assessment on him was an experiment that he had participated in August of 1951 in a small town in France called Pont-Saint-Esprit. And what basically Olson's division, which was part of Fort Detrick's Special Operations Division then, which was an ultra-secret group, what they did in France was to conduct, at the direction of the Army, a top-secret experiment using hallucinogenic drugs on the population of this small town. And essentially, as a result of that, about 500 or 600 people in that town went stark raving mad for a full day. 4 people committed suicide, and about 50 people were carted off to nearby asylums. And, of course, the agency and the Army didn't want that known in 1953 because primarily it wasn't that the newspapers would have had a field day with it, because in 1953 the newspapers probably would have gladly covered that up, but they were extremely concerned that the Russians would learn about the experiment and have a field day in their press. In Russia and Europe against the United States. It would have been extremely damaging to have it revealed that they launched an experiment in a foreign town in France.
Well, I mean, how about the country of France?
That too. But when Olson talked about that experiment, he basically, and that was about 2 weeks before he died, he essentially signed his own death warrant. The plan was to actually take him from New York, according to CIA files, to take him from New York and put him in an asylum, a mental institution that the agency had used for a number of years. And the institution was in Rockville, Maryland. It's no longer there. It was known as Chestnut Lodge. And it was a pretty well-to-do, you know, a lot of rich people went there when they suffered emotional or mental problems, but the agency favored the use of this institution for their own people, high-level employees that needed mental psychological treatment. And so it was decided to put Olson there. I suspect that had Olson not tried to flee in New York, that, you know, he would have made it to Chestnut Lodge and ostensibly been treated there, but probably within a week or two would have ended up hanging himself or committing suicide.
You figure they were going to do him in anyway.
Every intent to kill him,
uh-huh.
But not as brutally and as they had done in New York.
You think the CIA uses these tactics today? I guess they do. There's no reason to change.
I think they do. I'm not happy or proud or pleased or anything else to say that. I think there's lots of reasons to believe that they do. I think there was a recent case at Fort Detrick that's very analogous to the Olson case that involved the so-called anthrax letter killer, and that was a doctor called Dr. Bruce Ivins, and the FBI now tells us, now that he's dead, that there's no doubt whatsoever that he was the man responsible for sending anthrax through all the post offices and to Senator Leahy and Senator Daschle. And I've studied that as hard and as thoroughly as I can, and I just don't see the evidence there. I just don't see, and I don't see the motive there for this man to have done that. Initially, he was actually helping them with the investigation.
I was just looking at an article today. Evidently, no one in that lab believes this guy did it. That always sounded to me like somebody was giving those senators a message.
I think it was. Uh-huh. I want to be careful what I say. I don't want to say where I think there was some sort of follow the money activities there also, and that somebody, I don't think it would take a lot of work for anybody to look at it and figure out who stood to profit the most from those anthrax letters. But I think it was both that, the profit motive, and I think it was also a way to get back at Daschle in Leahy. People had forgotten that not long before that happened, Leahy had really embarrassed the CIA by leaking some information. So I think, you know, it was definitely a hand slap, if not just an outright attempt to murder Leahy and Daschle. I really don't know. I mean, it's been proven that what they got was anthrax, and had they themselves opened those letters and breathed, you know, some of those spores, they certainly would have been dead. But that's my theory, and I just, based on the evidence that's been put out about Ivins, I don't see a person that was motivated or inclined to do that.
Hank, it seems to me that in Washington, fear rules the day. In other words, we can't really expect these elected officials to do much, can we? They're all afraid for their lives. I mean, just like we were talking earlier about Obama. And now these senators.
Well, I think it's the same thing, right? The same thing with the president. I think you hit the nail right on the head. I think, they don't want to go near it. That goes into the same psychology with the senator or congressman saying, I don't know what the CIA's budget is, and I don't care. I don't care to know. I don't want to.
Unbelievable. Extortion, murder, kidnapping, torture.
Absolutely.
No one's going to do anything about it because they're afraid for their own safety. Seems to me mafia rules apply with government. Unbelievable.
Yeah, the work that Scott Horton did recently in Harper's Magazine with the three so-called prisoners at Guantanamo that committed suicide on the same night in the same manner, with their feet and hands tied, they nonetheless were all able to hang themselves separately in three different cells, and had needle marks all over their bodies, and had just coincidentally been interrogated by the CIA hours beforehand. That's inexcusable. I mean, you know, and people wonder why people in other countries don't care for Americans. I mean, these were three young men that had families and it, like all the rest of us, whose deaths had to be explained to mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, and who of course didn't buy the explanations because they made no sense whatsoever. Nobody can hang themselves with their hands and feet tied and rags shoved down their throats. Yet we're supposed to, the American public is supposed to just believe this stuff and not ask any questions and go on their merry way, or in a lot of cases, work the three jobs they have to work every day to make ends meet and don't have time to think about any of this stuff.
Now, Hank, in your book and also in our conversations, I take it you think the Army is as active as ever, maybe even more than the CIA.
I do, and I think the Army always has been. Mm-hmm. I think the Army, in a lot of ways, takes direction from the CIA, and the Army intelligence units, in a lot of cases, work closely with them. But I think the Army is as independent from the President and the Congress as the CIA is, perhaps even more
yet
so.
The average guy on the street thinks civilians control the Army and the military. But you suspect it's the other way around, I expect. Let's give the name of the book. People need to pick this up and read it.
Sure thing. It's my book is called The Terrible Mistake, and the subtitle is The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiments. It's available, and you can get it actually from any bookstore, any reputable bookstore, or you can order it online from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or the publisher Trine Day.
We've been discussing some pretty hot stuff here. Dangerous. Do you think you're in danger, Hank?
Well, no, but maybe after this guy. We've talked pretty bluntly, Jerry.
I understand.
Do you feel like you're in any danger?
Yes and no.
Same answer. I don't. At this point, I'm 63 years old. I don't.
Well, I'm older than
people
you.
I care a lot about, but I think what I've done is the right thing.
I think I'm like you. I'm on a mission.
Yeah, and if it results in people would be stupid for anything to happen to me right now, and I certainly don't want to be a martyr. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's not my ambition.
But I think it's pretty remarkable where two guys like you and I have to ask each other that question, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
Fear is operative these days, even here in the United States of America. I mean, it's almost like the old communist countries of old. When you and I were growing up, Hank.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right, and that's sort of what we're back to.
Yep. It's incredible. We'll be talking again.
Okay, thank you very much, Jerry. I really appreciate your talking to me.
Okay, we'll talk again.
Sure thing. Thanks a lot.
Bye.